From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we begin Country Music Week. Throughout this week, we'll feature interviews with groundbreaking performers and songwriters. Today, we'll hear from members of the Carter Cash family, Johnny Cash, June Carter Cash, Johnny's daughter, Roseanne Cash, and June's daughter, Carlene Carter. Roseanne and Carlene are singer-songwriters. The Carter Cash family, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Russia's parliament has overwhelmingly rejected President Boris Yeltsin's nominee for prime minister. NPR's Ann Garrels reports from Moscow.
Despite Chairman Mirden's warning that Russia is on the verge of economic breakdown, the parliament chose to extend the political vacuum. Only 94 out of 450 supported Viktor Chairman Mirden in today's confirmation vote. It was a dramatic turnabout from just yesterday, when Chairman Mirden, the president's aides, and parliamentary leaders had agreed on a compromise. Like rats fleeing a sinking ship, even key political figures like Moscow Mayor Yuri Lushkov abandoned Chernomyrdin. After first supporting him, Lushkov said he's disappointed Chernomyrdin's done nothing to reverse Russia's economic decline. The president can put Chernomyrdin's name forward twice more. If repeatedly defeated, Yeltsin can then dissolve parliament. The prospects for confirmation look bad. I'm Ann Garrels, NPR News, Moscow.
Japan's defense agency says North Korea today fired a newly developed ballistic missile over Japanese territory. Japanese officials say they knew of plans for the test and tried to stop it. A Pentagon official says the Defense Department views the test firing as a serious development. The launch came as the United States and North Korea have hit another impasse over a four-year-old agreement calling on the North to freeze its nuclear program. With no quick end in sight to the strike against Northwest Airlines, other air carriers have begun adding flights to Northwest's hub cities, Detroit, Minneapolis, and Memphis, where thousands of travelers have been stranded by the walkout. Both sides in the labor dispute say they're willing to talk, but no new negotiations are scheduled. From member station WDET, Jerome Vaughn has more.
Northwest has canceled all of its flights through Tuesday and its international flights through Wednesday. That's because the airline couldn't get up and running before then, even if a settlement were reached immediately. The pilots walked off the job Saturday morning over salary and job security issues. They're seeking a 15% pay raise over 5 years. The airline is offering a 10% raise. Northwest will lose nearly $27 million per day because of the strike. Company officials now say layoffs are a possibility in the near future. Businesses in Detroit, Minneapolis, and Memphis are expected to quickly feel the impact of the strike, too. Nearly 80% of the passengers flying into or out of those cities use Northwest. No new bargaining talks have been scheduled. For NPR News, this is Jerome Vaughn in Detroit.
1 year after the car crash in a Paris tunnel that took her life, Princess Diana is being remembered today in private and public ceremonies. Her sons, Princes William and Harry, attended a private mass near Balmoral Castle. Public memorial services are planned at London's cathedrals. The national flag, the Union Jack, flew at half-staff on government buildings and royal residences. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 131 points in heavy trading. And on the NASDAQ, the composite is now down nearly 70 points. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, the Dow's further slide today is an indication that all of the anxiety has not yet been wrung out of the market. NPR's Jack Spear has more.
The latest news out of Russia that any cooperative agreement aimed at getting the new government in place there seems to be falling apart, coupled with investor nervousness here in the U.S., is making for a rough start to the week for Wall Street. While the market briefly moved higher this morning, things turned negative pretty quickly. The technology stocks taking the biggest beating as investors sell out of one of the last sectors of the market to still be up for the year. The NASDAQ is down 4%. Shares of Dell Computer, America Online, Intel, and Cisco Systems are all lower today. The Commerce Department also released the new home sales numbers for July, and they were down, showing some of the bloom may be coming off that sector of the market. Sales of new homes fell 1.6% last month. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Chancellor Media is buying Whiteco Outdoor Advertising for about $930 million. A completion of the deal, Chancellor would own more than 35,000 billboards in the United States. Chancellor just last week agreed to merge with Capstar to form the country's largest group of radio stations. Viacom is planning to buy back up to $1.75 billion worth of its securities. Companies often use buybacks to increase earnings per share by reducing the number of outstanding shares. Viacom's operations include Blockbuster, MTV, and Paramount Pictures. China has announced a relief plan of $120 billion in bank loans to help agriculture and industry rebound from the recent widespread flooding in the country. Loans will also be extended to help homeowners rebuild or repair their homes. The flooding in China has left millions homeless and caused at least $20 billion in damage. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 200 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During this final week of the summer season, it's Country Music Week on Fresh Air, a week that we think you'll enjoy even if you don't consider yourself a country music fan. We're going to start by featuring the members of what's been called country music's first family, Johnny Cash, June Carter Cash, Johnny's daughter, singer-songwriter Roseanne Cash, and June's daughter, Carlene Carter, also a singer-songwriter. Johnny Cash is the only musician to be inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame, the Country Music Hall of Fame, and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Last fall, just after the publication of his autobiography, Cash cut short his tour, announcing that he had a progressive disorder of the nervous system. He said very little about it publicly, but his book is about to come out in paperback with a new chapter about his condition. I spoke with him a couple of days before he revealed his condition. Let's start with a song from one of his two recent CDs, which were produced by Rick Rubin, who usually works with rap and rock performers. These recordings gained a new young audience for Johnny Cash. This song is Nick Lowe's song, The Beast in Me.
The beast in me is caged by frail and fragile bars. Restless by day and by night, rants and rages at the stars. God help the beast in me.
Johnny Cash grew up during the Depression. I asked him how his father earned a living then.
My father was a cotton farmer first, but he didn't have any land, or what land he had, he lost it in the Depression. So he worked as a woodman and cut pulpwood for the paper mills, rode the rails in boxcars, going from one harvest to another to try to make a little money picking fruit or vegetables. Did every kind of work imaginable, from painting to shoveling to herding cattle. And he's always been such an inspiration to me because of the varied kinds of things that he did and the kind of life he lived. He inspired me so that all the things he did, so far from being a soldier in World War I to being an old man in his patio sitting on the porch watching the dogs, I think about his life and it would inspire me to go my own other direction. And I just like to explore minds and the desires of the people out there.
You know, it's interesting that you say your father inspired you so much. I'm sure you wouldn't have wanted to lead his life picking cotton.
I did. Until I was 18 years old, that is.
Mm-hmm.
Then I picked the guitar, and I've been picking it since.
Right. Did you have a plan to get out? Did you very much want to get out of the town where you were brought up and get out of picking cotton?
Yeah, I knew that when I left there at the age of 18, I wouldn't be back.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of common knowledge among all the people there that when you graduate from high school here, you go to college or go get a job or something and do it on your own. And having been familiar with hard work, it was no problem for me. But first I hitchhiked to Pontiac, Michigan, and got a job working in Fisher Body, making those 1951 Pontiacs. I worked there 3 weeks, got really sick of it, went back home and joined the Air Force.
You have such a wonderful, deep voice. Did you start singing before your voice changed?
Oh, yeah. I got no deep voice today. I've got a cold. But when I was so young, I had a high tenor voice. I used to sing Bill Monroe songs, and I sing Dennis Day songs, like
sang
on the songs that he sang on the Jack Benny show.
Wow!
Every week he sang an old Irish folk song, and next day in the fields I'd be singing that song if I was working in the fields, and I always loved those songs. And with my high tenor, I thought I was pretty good, you know, almost as good as Dennis Day. But when I was 16, my father and I cut wood all day long, and I was swinging that crosscut saw and hauling wood. And when I walked in the back door late that afternoon, I was singing, "Everybody gonna have religion and glory, everybody gonna be singing a story." I sang those old gospel songs for my mother, and she said, "Is that you?" And I said, "Yes, ma'am." And she came over and put her arms around me and said, "God's got his hands on you." I still think of that, you know?
She realized you had a gift.
That's what she said, yeah. She called it the gift.
Well, how did you feel about your voice changing? It must have stunned you if you were singing like Dennis O'Day and then suddenly you were singing like Johnny Cash.
I don't know. I guess when I was a tenor, I just, and when it changed, I thought, well, it goes right along with these hormones and everything's working out really good, you know? I felt like my voice was becoming a man's voice.
Right, right. So did you start singing different songs as your voice got deeper?
Mm-hmm. Lucky Old Son, Memories Are Made of This, 16 Tons. I developed a pretty unusual style, I think. If I'm anything, I'm not a singer, but I'm a song stylist.
What's the difference?
Well, I say I'm not a singer, so that means I can't sing. But doesn't it?
Well, but I mean, that's not true. I understand you're making a distinction, but you certainly can sing. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. Well, song stylist is like to take an old folk song like Delia's Gone and do a modern white man's version of it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those I did that way. You know, I would take songs that I'd loved as a child and redo them in my mind for the new voice I had, the low voice.
I know that you briefly took singing lessons, and you say in your new book that your singing teacher told you, you know, don't let anybody change your voice, don't even bother with the singing lessons. How did you end up taking lessons in the first place?
My mother did that, and she was determined that I was going to leave the farm and do well in life, and she thought with the gift I might be able to do that. So she took in washing. She got a washing machine in 1942, as soon as they got electricity. And she took in washing. She washed the school teacher's clothes, and anybody she could, and sent me for singing lessons for $3 per lesson. And that's how she made the money to send me.
What was your reaction when the teacher told you, don't let anybody change what you're doing? I'm not going to teach you anymore.
I was pretty happy about that. I didn't really want to change, you know. I felt good about my voice.
You left home when you were about 18. And then how old were you when you actually went to Memphis?
Well, I went to Memphis after I finished the Air Force in 1954.
Mm-hmm.
I lived on that farm until I went to the Air Force. I was in there four years, and when I came back, I got married and moved to Memphis. Got an apartment. Started trying to sell appliances at a place called Home Equipment Company, but I couldn't sell anything and didn't really want to. All I wanted was the music, and if somebody in the house was playing music when I would come, I would stop and sing with them. Like one time, Gus Cannon, the man who wrote Walk Right In,
mm-hmm.
which was a hit for the Rooftop Singers, and I sat on the front porch with him day after day when I found him and sing those songs.
When you got to Memphis, Elvis Presley had already recorded That's All Right. Sam Phillips had produced him for his label Sun Records. You called Sam Phillips and asked for an audition. Did it take a lot of nerve to make that phone call?
No, it just took the right time. I was fully confident that I was going to see Sam Phillips and to record for him. That when I called him, I thought, I'm going to get on Sun Records. So I called him, and he turned me down flat. Then 2 weeks later, I called, turned down again. He told me over the phone that he couldn't sell gospel music, so because it was independent, not a lot of money, you know. So I didn't press that issue, but one day I just decided I'm ready to go. So I went down with my guitar and sat on the front steps of his recording studio and met him when he came in. And I said, I'm John Cash. I'm the one that's been calling. And if you'd listen to me, I believe you'd be glad you did. And he said, come on in. Well, that was a good lesson for me, you know, to believe in myself.
So what did Phillips actually respond to most of the songs that you played him?
He responded most to a song of mine called Hey Porter, which was on the first record. But he asked me to go write a love song or maybe a bitter weeper. So I wrote a song called Cry, 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 went back in and recorded that for the other side of the record.
You say in your book you had to do 35 takes of Cry, Cry, Cry. Why did it take so many takes?
It was too simple. We were trying to make something complicated out of it. It was the simplest song in the world ever written. And invariably, at some time during a take, the guitar player would mess up or the bass player or I would mess up and we'd have to do it over. It's not unusual, though, to do a song 35 times.
Were you nervous because it was your first recording?
No, not at all. I had confidence that I was going to do it. I'd been singing in Germany in the Air Force. I'd been singing with my little group called the Landsberg Barbarians. And we played in honky-tonks and guest houses and wherever we could, you know, when we weren't working.
Well, why don't we hear Cry, 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 which was on the first single that Sun Records released by you.
Okay.
Everybody knows where you go when the sun goes down. I think you only live to see the lights uptown. I wasted my time when I would try, try, try. 'Cause when the lights have lost their glow, you cry, cry, cry. Soon your sugar daddies will all be gone. You wake up some cold day and find you're alone. You'll call for me, but I'm gonna tell you bye, bye, bye. When I turn around and walk away, you'll cry, cry, cry. You're gonna cry, cry.
That's Johnny Cash's first single. We'll hear more of our interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring an interview recorded last fall with Johnny Cash. When we left off, we were talking about the beginning of his recording career. What was it like when you started to go on tour? You know, after coming from the cotton fields, it's true, I mean, you'd been in the Army and you'd been abroad, you know, with the Army. But what was it like for you in the early days of getting recognized, you know, traveling around the country?
Well, when I started playing concerts, I went out from Memphis to Arkansas, Louisiana, and Tennessee, played the little towns there that I would go out myself in my car and set up the show or get the show booked in those theaters. And then along about 3 months later, Elvis Presley asked me to sing with him at the Overton Park Shell in Memphis. And I sang Cry, 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 and Hey Porter. And from that time on, I was on my way, and I knew it, I felt it, and I loved it. So Elvis asked me to go on tour with him, and I did. I worked with Elvis four or five tours in the next year or so. And I was always intrigued by his charisma. You know, I just, you can't be in the building without looking at him, you know? And he inspired me so that with his fire and energy that I guess that inspiration from him really helped me to go.
What were the temptations like for a young married man like yourself on the road, you know, slowly becoming a star?
Fame was pretty hard to handle, actually. The country boy in me tried to break loose and take me back to the country, but the music was stronger. The urge to go out and do the gift was a lot stronger. And the temptations were women, girls, which I loved, and then amphetamines, not very much later, from running all night, you know, in our cars on tour, and the doctors got these nice pills that give us energy and keep us awake. So I started taking those, and I liked them so much I got addicted to them. And then I started taking downers or sleeping pills to come down and rest after 2 or 3 days. So it became a cycle. I was taking the pills for a while, and then the pills started taking me.
I want to play what I think was your first big hit, I Walk the Line.
Mm-hmm. That was my third record.
And you wrote the song. Tell me the story of how you wrote it and what you were thinking about at the time.
In the Air Force, I had an old Wilcox K recorder and used to hear guitar runs on that recorder going dun, 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 like the chords on I Walk the Line. And I always wanted to write a love song using that theme, you know, that tune. And so I started to write the song, and I was in Gladewater, Texas one night with Carl Perkins, and I said, I've got a good idea for a song. And I sang him the first verse that I had written, and I said, it's called Because You're Mine. And he said, I Walk the Line is a better title. So I changed it to I Walk the Line.
Now, were you thinking of your own life when you wrote this?
It was kind of a prodding to myself to play it straight, Johnny.
And was this, I think I read that this was supposed to be a ballad. I mean, it was supposed to be slow when you first wrote it.
That's the way I sang it, yeah, at first. But Sam wanted it up, you know, up-tempo, and I put paper in the strings of my guitar to get that sound, and with a bass and a lead guitar, there it was, bare and stark, that song was, when it was released, and I heard it on the radio, and I really didn't like it, and I called Sam Phillips and asked him, please not send out any more records of that song.
Why?
But he laughed at me. I just didn't like the way it sounded to me. I didn't know I sounded that way, and I didn't like it, I don't know. But he said, let's give it a chance, and it was just a few days until that's all it took to take off.
That's funny. I mean, you'd heard your voice before, hadn't you?
Mm-hmm.
But so it was something in your own singing you weren't liking when you heard it?
Well, the music and my voice together, I just felt like it was really weird. But I got used to it very quickly. I don't know if that I didn't hate it, but I just didn't like it. I thought I could do better.
Well, let's hear I Walk the Line. This is a great record. It was great then, and it still is. This is Johnny Cash.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line. I find it very, very easy to be true. I find myself alone when each day's through. Yes, I'll admit that I'm a fool for you. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
I think it was in the late 1950s that you started doing prison concerts, which you eventually became very famous for.
Mm-hmm.
What got you started performing in prison?
Well, I had a song called Folsom Prison Blues that was a hit just before I walked the line. And the people in Texas heard about it at the state prison and got to writing me letters asking me to come down there. So I responded, and then the warden called me and asked if I would come down and do a show for the prisoners in Texas. And so we went down, and there's a rodeo at all these shows that the prisoners have there. And in between the rodeo things, they asked me to set up and do two or three songs. So that was what I did. I did Folsom Prison Blues, which they thought was their song, you know. And I walked the line, ring Hey Porter, Cry, Cry, Cry. And then the word got around on the grapevine that Johnny Cash was all right and that you ought to see him. So the requests started coming in from other prisoners all over the United States. And then the word got around. So I always wanted to record that, you know, to record a show. Because of the reaction I got, it was far and above anything I had ever had in my life. The complete explosion of noise and reaction that they gave me with every song. So then I came back the next year and played the prison again, the New Year's Day show. Came back again the third year and did the show. And then I kept talking to my producers at Columbia about recording one of those shows. It was so exciting. I said that the people out there ought to share that, you know, and feel that excitement too. So preacher friend, a friend of mine named Floyd Gressett set it up for us. And Lou Robin and a lot of other people involved at Folsom Prison. So we went into Folsom on February 11th, 1968. And recorded a show live.
Well, why don't we hear Folsom Prison Blues from your Live at Folsom Prison record? This is Johnny Cash.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash.
I hear the train a-coming. It's rolling around a bend. And I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison. And time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps a-rolling on down to San Antone. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry.
Sue it!
That's Johnny Cash live at Folsom Prison. Our interview was recorded last fall, just a couple of days before he announced that he had a progressive disorder of the nervous system. We'll hear more from Johnny Cash, as well as interviews with other members of his family, in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're listening to the Carter Family, recorded in the late 20s. Coming up, we hear from Mother Maybelle Carter's daughter, June Carter Cash. We'll hear more from June's husband, Johnny Cash, and from singer-songwriter daughters, Roseanne Cash and Carlene Carter.
Dark and a troubled side of life, there's a bright and a sunny side too. Though we meet with the darkness and strife, today,
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Country Music Week on Fresh Air, and today we're hearing from the Carter Cash family. Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash have been performing together since 1962 and have been married since 68. Here's their 1967 recording, Jackson.
We got married in a fever, hotter than a pepper sprout. We've been talking about Jackson ever since the fire went out. I'm going to Jackson. I'm gonna mess her.
June was performing long before she met Johnny. She was born into what many people consider the first family of country music. Her mother was Mabel Carter of the original Carter family, whose performances and records spread the sound of Appalachian ballads and gospel music. I asked Johnny Cash how he first met June. You married your second wife, your wife June Carter, now June Carter Cash, in 1968. Mm-hmm. How did you first meet the members of the Carter family, the kind of first family of country music?
I met June at the backstage at the Grand Ole Opry when I did my first appearance as a guest artist. And it was 5 years again, till I saw her again. And we started working together, touring, beginning in Des Moines in January 1962. And we've been together ever since. I met her family about my second tour that we had June on, because I asked them to all come and be a part of the show. So I kind of got into those people and became one of their family. And it felt good to go out with them.
What was it like traveling with a family instead of being on your own? Being on your own, leaving the family behind?
I really don't like to do an appearance without June Carter. And what it would be like being alone, it would be awfully lonely to me. I'm very comfortable with, you know, how we do it, my wife and my son on the show and a daughter or two. And it feels so good. I would hate to think that I had to do it all alone.
Did it change your life to have a family that really understood the performing life, because it was their life, too?
Very much so, yeah, right.
What was the difference? I mean, why was that so important?
Well, there's something about families singing together that is just better than any other groups you can pick up or make, you know? If it's family, if it's blood on blood, then it's going to be better. The voices singing their parts are going to be tighter, and they're going to be more on pitch. Because it's, as I say, it's a bloodline on bloodline.
Johnny Cash recorded last fall. June Carter Cash has been Johnny Cash's partner on stage and off. In 1963, he had a big hit with a song she wrote called Ring of Fire. Before we hear an interview with June, let's listen to Ring of Fire as recorded by June with her sisters and Mother Mabel Carter.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring. Bound by wild desire, I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher, and it burns, burns, burns.
I spoke with June Carter Cash in 1987 and asked her about the beginning of her career.
I was about 10 years old. About 10, I think. And I really didn't know if I was going to be able to perform or not. I had two sisters who could perform, and when you're standing there and you're used to just running and catching light bugs and June bugs and riding the motorcycle behind your daddy and being a tomboy, you don't know if you can sing or not.
Did you want to perform?
Oh, I hadn't even thought about it. I didn't think I could. But then Mother said, you know, you're going to sing, or at least I guess you are, and you're also going to learn to play that auto harp and that mandolin and that guitar and whatever. So within about a week's time, I learned to sing. I had to. Believe me, Terry, I was up and down that scale because I really didn't know where I was going to begin with.
Sounds like you didn't have a lot of confidence in your singing.
I really didn't, but I had a lot of guts. I really didn't mind trying anything, and I think that's one reason in the beginning that I used to do comedy in the beginning. I just did it because I didn't think I could sing as good as my sisters.
What were the best shows, your favorite shows to do?
Well, I've had a lot of different shows in my life. The Days with the Carter Family, that was a wonderful kind of thing. I can remember doing shows from the days in the old coal fields where there was no electricity at all, and they put the lamps on the front of the stage. I went from that to having our first public address system, doing the little concerts around in schoolhouses and then in larger auditoriums when the Carter Family was around.
When you were young, were you aware of how important your mother was in country music?
I really had no idea. I honest to goodness thought everybody alive had a sweet little blue-eyed mother that picked the wildwood flower on the guitar. But Terry, the one thing that reminded me when my mother did pass away was the television cameras that came from all of the major networks, and then I began to know. And, of course, if there's the times that you ever read history books in country music, she had a strong influence on our music. And, of course, my Uncle A.P. Carter and the songs of the Carter Family. That's kind of a basis for our country music today.
June Carter Cash. As a young woman, she left the world she was so closely associated with and moved to California and New York. She married country music performer Carl Smith and had two daughters, Carlene and Rosie. But when the culture shock of big city life became too much for her, she moved back to Nashville and the Grand Ole Opry. That's when Johnny Cash came into her life. When you realized that you were both in love, were you ever afraid to marry him because of his chemical dependency?
Oh, of course, of course. I only decided 6 months before we were married. I made my mind up, okay, if you feel that you can stay straight, I will marry you. If that's what you really think that you can do. And he stayed straight for 6 months. I handed in my resignation to the Grand Ole Opry, and I thought, if you die, I will stand near you while you die. If you live, I will live with you, and I will be with you. I will help you whatever you do. But it was a total commitment that I made at that point. And he never let me down.
In your new book, you've written about women friends and women in your family who were abused by their husbands or who had to put up with drug and alcohol problems that their husbands had. How much power do you think a loving wife has to change her husband if he has a problem either with violence or with drugs or alcohol?
Well, you have much more power if you're a praying woman than you could believe. I prayed continually, and I lifted up all my problems to God. If you have a person who is a chemically dependent person in your family, child or husband, whatever the situation would be, if you pray hard believing that God can help you and you just lift that up, I am living proof that it can work.
You wrote the song Ring of Fire, which Johnny Cash recorded, had a big hit with it. Did you write that song with him in mind?
Yes, I did. You know, he didn't even know, but I think I'd come to grips with the fact that I was in love with this man. He was still at that time with his wife. I was still married at the time. I think that's what the song was about, because, I mean, I couldn't tell anybody. How could I tell anybody? Because it was like a ring of fire.
When you gave the song to Johnny Cash to record, did he know that it was about him?
I don't know. My sister recorded it first, Anita, and it was more like the Carter Family might have done it, because we were primarily more folk music. And so then Anita and Helen and Mother and I sung it with John, and we put the trumpets on it, and it became a big, big song. It's been recorded over 100 times.
June Carter Cash, recorded in 1987. Here's Johnny Cash singing her song, Ring of Fire.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring. Bound by wild desire, I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire.
I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
Coming up, we'll hear from singer, songwriter, and author Roseanne Cash, Johnny Cash's daughter. This is Fresh Air. Today on Country Music Week, we're featuring interviews with the Carter Cash family. Roseanne Cash was born in 1955, the daughter of Johnny Cash and his first wife, Vivian. They separated when Roseanne was 11, and she stayed with her mother in Southern California. But she later went into her father's business. Roseanne has been described in the New York Times as the most compelling singer and songwriter to emerge from the progressive wing of country music. She's had 11 number one singles on the country music charts. Now she's as connected to the world of alternative rock as she is to country. I spoke with her in 1996, after the release of her CD called 10 Song Demo, which was an album of her demo records. Let's hear a song from it.
Standing on the edge tonight. Don't know if I'll fall or fly, but that's the price you pay for temptation. There's no other way through temptation. That's the price you pay. Well, I'll let the rivers cry through my eyes.
At the same time this CD was released, Roseanne Cash had also just published a book of short stories called Bodies of Water, which I asked her about. One of the characters in your new collection of stories is writing in part from the perspective of when she was 11.
Mm-hmm.
And when she was a child, she thinks, in the world in which I live, men are regarded to be irredeemable, selfish, and cruel, and women to be unfailingly virtuous.
Mm-hmm.
I know I can never truly take my place in that picture. Did people give you those messages when you were growing up?
Well, yes. I grew up around Southern women, and there was a very powerful stereotype of Southern women had and believed into, and the men too, obviously, that men were to be somehow redeemed by women, or they were irredeemable. And I know that there's actually some kind of spiritual basis for that. I mean, just to get off on a tangent for a second, that there are some cultures that believe that men achieve salvation through women. Well, certainly not Christianity, but other ones. But yeah, so there was this unspoken message that women were to be good and true and long-suffering, and men were to be wild and, you know, making mistakes and just waiting for a good woman to come along and fix him up. Well, I just knew. I mean, writing in that story, that's very autobiographical too. In fact, that whole story is the first one, We Are Born. I knew that I could never fit into that. That I didn't believe it, and that I was risking being judged, you know, by the whole ancestral plate there, and that I was going to have to come up with something new for myself.
Well, you know, I'm thinking your father, Johnny Cash, is the ultimate in macho,
mm-hmm.
and had a lot of problems, too, earlier in his life with drugs and so on. Mm-hmm. Did you see your mother as a person who was supposed to redeem your father?
Yes. I mean, my mother was Catholic, or is Catholic, and, you know, she's very long-suffering and very fiercely maternal. Her children were first in her lives and, you know, thought she could just work anything out with my father. Well, you know, some things can't be worked out. So, you know, it was tough for both of them.
And if your goal is, if your goal in life as a woman is to redeem a man, and you quote fail in that task, then everything is blown.
Right, the whole cover's blown. Then what do? You have to come up with something else.
right. So there must have been some rough periods for your mother.
Certainly, but you know, somehow assimilating that, and I came up with a different answer for myself that I was only supposed to redeem myself.
Which is hard enough.
Which is hard enough, right. Let's just keep men out of the picture until that happens.
Now, before you made your first record, I think it was right after you graduated high school, you toured as a backup singer with your father, Johnny Cash. Mm-hmm. Did you know the songs in his repertoire?
Oh, sure. I mean, they had gone in by osmosis over the years, yeah.
So what was it like singing backup harmony with him?
Oh, it wasn't real. I mean, people make a thing.
It wasn't real?
It wasn't real. I wasn't really a singer. It was just cute. I was 18, 19 years old, and my stepsister, June Carter's daughter, Rosie, and I would walk out and cling to each other like we were standing on a cliff and tremble and sing these two little parts on a couple songs, you know, and it was just... It was just a dad bringing the kids out for a little while, you know. It wasn't a real thing.
So it was a way to be closer to him for a while?
It was a way to go on the road with my dad after high school and see the world and play.
I'm sure you observed the country music life
being
on the road with him. What did you like and what did you find distasteful about it?
I loved the travel at that time. I loved, you know, the nice hotels. I loved the attention. I loved hanging out in the dressing room and learning how to play guitar. I loved going to Europe, and I loved being educated about nice things, you know. And I would watch him every night, and just looking at his back or his profile, you know, and see what he was and see how long he had been doing this, and he seemed so timeless to me, as if he could have been a medieval jester or someone from the future, you know. He has this incredibly resonant quality to him that makes him absolutely timeless. And I saw how he related to an audience. It was a wonderful education.
Now, if you don't mind my asking about this, I know you've alluded to it in your work and talked about it before. There was a period when you were doing cocaine. And I was wondering, you know, after seeing the effects of drugs on your father earlier in his life, did you take that as a warning signal that, you know, being on the road and doing drugs was probably not going to be a very healthy thing?
Well, you know how it's like you can't tell kids anything. They have to make their own mistakes, right?
Mm-hmm.
I just had to go through it, I suppose. I did. I think my life really began over when I got clean.
Roseanne Cash recorded in 1996. She's currently working on a new book and a new recording. We'll hear from June Carter Cash's daughter, singer-songwriter Carlene Carter, after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Look yonder coming down that railroad track. Hey, look yonder coming down that railroad track. It's the Orange Blossom Special, bringing my baby back. Ooh.
Carlene Carter is the daughter of June Carter and stepdaughter of Johnny Cash. As a girl, she sang country music with the Carter family. When Carlene started performing on her own, she played rock. Her first solo album featured British rockers Graham Parker and Nick Lowe, to whom she was married for several years. When I spoke with Carlene Carter in 1990, she had just released her album I Fell in Love, which was strongly influenced by her country roots. I asked her if she related to music as a kid differently than she did as an adult.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, when I was a kid, it was just like something my mom did. You know, it was my mom's job. And You know, I was so used to it. My grandmother, my mom, my aunts, everybody in my family was in country music, and I kind of took it for granted. It took actually moving to England and Dave Edmonds saying to me, hey, do you know George Jones? For me to like sort of go, hey, maybe country's kind of cool. You know, I was like a normal teenager, and I listened to rock music all the time. You know, I listened to Top 40 radio and went to all the sock hops in Hendersonville High, and, you know, I was dancing to the rock and roll stuff. So my first band was a rock and roll band when I was 12 with my cousin, and we were playing things like Sunshine of Your Love. So I wasn't really grounded in country music like a lot of people think, and it took me coming back to America and working with them to learn about where I really did come from and actually to start appreciating it.
Did you sing with the Carter family when you were a child?
Yeah, not by their choice, really. They used to, like, be on stage, and my mom would sit me and my sister Rosie on the side of the stage and say, now, you stay here, and Mom will be off stage in a minute. Next thing she'd know, she'd turn around, and I'd be standing there right next to her dancing on the stage. And then they started letting me sing a song. I think I was about four. They started letting me do that old song, Charlie Brown, he's a clown. You know, that one,
Fee, Fi,
Fo, Fum, I smell smoke. Yeah. So even then, you know, I wasn't like conforming to the traditional country music.
So what was it like to be a child on the road traveling with the family?
I was car sick a lot.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, that's like one of my most vivid memories is being car sick. But I don't know. It's, in a way, it's like conditioned me to be able to go on tour for long periods of time and it not bother me. I can fall asleep anywhere. That's one of the things. You know, I can sleep in a car, I can sleep in a bus, I can sleep in a train, I can sleep in a plane. But and most everybody gets real uncomfortable, but I don't have a problem with it. And I know that that came from it. Being a kid is like, I missed, you know, I wanted to be normal like everyone else. And I remember like kind of resenting not being able to play softball and because I had to go on the road when I was on weekends because Mama wanted me to be with her. And, you know, I'd always want to be with Mama, but also I kind of wanted to be a normal kid and have a this mom and dad that made dinner and ate set dinner every night. And but, you know, that was normal to me then, so it didn't seem that weird.
You have a song on the new album called Me and the Wildwood Rose about you and your sister singing with your grandmother and the family.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the song.
Well, it's really about being there and seeing it all happen. When my producer's name is Howie Epstein, and he has really encouraged me in broadening my writing into, you know, and trying to stop me from writing all these songs about relationships, which seemed to have been the real focal point for me for a lot of years. He suggested that I write about when I was a kid and what it was like and write about my grandmother a little bit and family things, and because he knew how much she meant to me and how much a part of my life she was. Rosie is also a very important part of my life. We were, you know, being kids in a musical family, you know, even though we went with them a lot, we also were home a lot. And we, you know, tended, I was a little mama. I kind of took care of Rosie, and she was always my baby, not my mama's.
In my grandma's house, her children would sing guitars at twain, and then laughter would ring. I was little, but I was the biggest kid. I wanted to do what
eventually rebelled against your family, didn't you? Didn't you run away at the age of 15?
No, I didn't run away. I just, you know, you're either dumb or you're pregnant when you get married at 15, and I was both. So, yeah, I got married at a real early age, and I wouldn't change a thing. I wouldn't change that at all because I have a beautiful daughter who's 18 now. And I lived my life real fast. I was always in a real hurry to get everywhere. And that, you know, I had two kids before I was 20, and those are my two children. And I seemed to spend my youth in my 20s as in like having a teenagehood time. But I didn't really particularly rebel. I just was anxious to get on with my life.
How did your life change when, I think you were 12, when your mother married Johnny Cash?
It was pretty different. We grew up, I actually live in the house that I grew up in until I was 12. I've moved back to that house. But we mowed our yard, we mowed our fields, we took care of all the grounds, so to speak, and we always had a lot of work to do. We had a little farm, and when Mom married John, we basically just packed our suitcases with our clothes in it and left everything at our home, and it was like, whoa, you know, culture shock, because suddenly, you know, that was at the height of his career. Suddenly we were in limos all the time and, you know, traveling first class in airlines, and it was real different, and but that's something else I wouldn't have changed for the world, because I got to see a lot of different places. I got to meet a lot of different people that I never would have met had she not met him. Plus, he's a great guy, and he was a really good daddy to us.
Carlene Carter recorded in 1990. She's been touring internationally and writing new songs. Let's close our Carter Cash family show with a song from Johnny Cash's latest recording, Unchained. Last year, Cash disclosed that he was diagnosed with a progressive disorder of the nervous system. In spite of it, he's working on a new CD, which, like the past two, will be produced by Rick Rubin. Our program was produced today by Naomi Person with Anne-Marie Baldonado. I'm Terry Gross.
Take one fresh and tender kiss. Add one stolen night of bliss. One girl, one boy, some grief, some joy, memories are made of this. Don't forget a small moonbeam, fold it lightly with a dream. Your lips and mine to sip the wine. Memories are made of this. Then at the wedding bells, one house where lovers dwell, three little kids for the flavor. Stir carefully through the day. See how the flavor stays. These are the dreams that we will savor.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
First thing I remember knowing is a lonesome whistle blowing and a youngin's dream of growing up to ride.
On the next Fresh Air, as our Country Music Week continues, Merle Haggard tells us how he went from prison inmate to country music star. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
One and only rebel child from a family meek and mild. My mama seemed to know.